Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, August 20th, 2002, and this session at Holden is entitled Jesus Makes a Difference, In and Out of the Wilderness, Breaking Down Walls. It is presented by Stan Olson, and it is tape number OLS-2002-02. Let's listen in.
Well, I'll start off with t-shirts so I don't forget to do it. Today's t-shirt is from our Companion Synod, the Southeastern Diocese of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in South Africa. This is a church made up almost entirely of blacks of the Zulu tribe. This is the KwaZulu-Natal area, or Zululand, those who grew up on missionary stories. To relate to these folks, we have to cross many boundaries and many kinds of boundaries. In the first place, it's on the opposite side of the globe, almost literally, from Minnesota. Many national boundaries, continents, economic, racial, historical, all kinds of boundaries. I want you to start this morning getting into our topic, Jesus Makes a Difference in Terms of Boundaries, in groups of two or three, just talking a little bit about some of the boundaries that separate people today. Maybe for good, maybe for ill, or maybe for both. But what are some of the boundaries? Just take a minute, talk to some people around you about what some of those boundaries are. Boundaries, barriers, divisions that separate us. Okay, you don't seem to be having any trouble coming up with something to put in your list. Now, not for conversation with your neighbor, but I just want you to go from a general discussion of what are the boundaries that separate us to thinking about what boundaries separate me. Think for yourself. You as an individual, what boundaries separate you from other people in a way that you may not be completely happy with or somewhat struggling with? So this is not to share, but just think about that a little bit. What are the boundaries in your own life that you are very much aware of? The boundaries, the barriers, the divisions. Just a word of review. Yesterday, some of you were here, I recognize, and probably some of you were not, and we're told to make these things discreet so that you don't have to have been here yesterday to pick up. I do want to just make a couple comments. We talked about miracle stories a little bit in general, about these being stories that are meant to draw people's attention to Jesus, to make people think about the significance of Jesus, and particularly to connect Jesus as one who is sent by God, has godly power, is doing godly work, however you wanted to characterize that. We talked about the purpose of the miracles. We're talking about nature miracles and healing miracles yesterday, the calming of the sea, the casting out of demons, healing of a leper. We talked about the purpose of what Jesus was doing there as fulfillment, not patching, not just remedying things that are wrong, but fulfillment. In other words, a forward-looking thing. Remember the t-shirt, people of hope. The notion of looking forward. That's a basic element of how Jesus is making a difference there in those stories. And then we talked a little bit, I think it was in this session in particular, we talked about the question of what do we do about the fact that in those stories in particular, we're dealing with things that we have trouble handling with our scientific worldview? Jesus says, peace be still, when the wind ceases, and so on. And the question is raised, well, if, or I should say, since Mark believed that's what actually happened, does that invalidate Mark's point for us? I don't think we resolved that question. I didn't intend to resolve it for you. And I won't resolve today's questions either. I might as well warn you right now. We're dealing with some tricky things, some difficult things. But what I want to push you back to on that kind of question, and I'll do it again today, is to think about what's the purpose of the story? Why is the story there? And the story is to point to Christ. To take the stilling of the storm one, for example, clearly Mark wants to say some things about Jesus as linked to God the Creator. That's in the background, but the kind of the main thrust of that story is, who is Jesus? And you are invited to awe, to wonder. And we talked just a little bit about wonder and worship, that to the sense of awe brings us to the appropriate place to be in relation to Jesus, which is a worshipful stance of giving worth to, acknowledging who he is. Today, we're going to look at another set of stories and some complementary texts that are doing something a little bit different. The first one, little background. I asked you to imagine what the boundaries were in your lives and in our world. In the ancient Near East, in Israel, in Palestine, at the time that the New Testament is written, there are, of course, they also have all kinds of boundaries. They have slavery, so they've got master and slave boundaries. They have that they're a nation ruled by a distant emperor, so they've got that kind of governance, oppressive boundaries. They have, of course, economic differentiation, just as we do, and they have one that we're very aware of from the scriptures, which is the Jew non-Jew boundary. Like almost every other group, identifiable group, some of the time at least, it was us and them distinguishing themselves over against to be part of this group or not, and their word for the others was Gentile. Or the nations. The Gentiles are the nations. It's kind of the people of God and the nations, everybody else. It looks, our translations use Gentile, which makes it look like it's a technical term. And it probably almost had become that, but basically it's just a way of saying us and them. So that's a very key distinction for them. That's somewhat related to nationality, but not entirely. It is fundamentally a question of, do you worship the true God? Is your life governed by the Torah? So that's the fundamental distinction. You need to know some of this to listen to this story. Now, chapter 7, verse something or other, 24. And I'll again invite you to close your eyes and just listen to it. It's a familiar story. When I was a young man, I went to visit a shut-in. The shut-in was young pastor. He'd say, don't you need a little more light, pastor? And I'd always say, no, this is fine. Now, I'll move over here. Would you close your eyes and listen? From there, Jesus went out and went away to the region of Tyre. He entered a house and did not want anyone to know he was there. Yet he could not escape notice, but a woman with a little daughter, whose little daughter had an unclean spirit, immediately heard about him. And she came and bowed down at his feet. Now the woman was a Gentile of Syrophoenician origin. She begged Jesus to cast the demon out of her daughter. He said to her, "Let the children be fed first, for it's not fair to take the children's food and throw it to the dogs." But she answered him, "Sir, even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs." Then he said to her, "For saying that, you may go. The demon has left your daughter." So she went home, found the child lying on the bed, and the demon gone. Fairly obvious, this little conversation at the middle. Well, let me first comment. Miracle stories, stories of astonishment. In this case, we have kind of two astonishments. There is the healing, but you notice how peripheral it is? We talked yesterday about the structure of a miracle story, problem, miracle, and proof. Here, it's the problem section that gets expanded. The miracle is peripheral. So the other astonishment is what we want to look at, which is the boundary crossing, the Jew-Gentile, Jesus-Gentile boundary. He said to the woman whose daughter has a demon, "Let the children be fed first." It's not fair. It's not, the word just means good. It's not good to take the children's bread and give it to the dogs. The children here obviously are the Jewish people, and the dogs are the Gentiles, the non-Jews, and the bread is the benefits of Jesus. Dogs is what in this era would have been at least as disparaging a thing to say about somebody as it is in our era. Very, very Deb's fighting words kind of comment. She comes back at him with, "Yes, but even the dogs get to eat the crumbs from the children." Having had dinner next to Justin Stewart, 2-year-old, I remember that the dogs can eat quite well. And he says to her, "For saying that, go your way. Your child will be well. The demon has left your daughter." Interesting things going on here. Is there faith in this story? We haven't talked yet about faith in the miracle stories. Is there faith in this one? The word isn't used.
It isn't Matthew when Matthew adds to it.
Yeah, I should have commented. This happened. I didn't realize this, but this was the text for last Sunday. Yeah, Matt and Ben preached on it Sunday night, so some of you heard that sermon, and which is a little larger, longer version. No mention of faith here. So Mark is presumed to be the older gospel, so the older version of the story. Is there faith here? You say Matthew added the reference to it. Was Matthew out of line, or somebody wants to comment about it?
There's persistence.
Persistence, okay.
There's more of hope than faith.
Okay.
Well, isn't there a reason that you want the crumbs? Mm-hmm. There must be some benefit to the crumbs if you want them. Mm-hmm. That must imply some faith or some belief.
Yeah. Persistence, hope, reason for wanting it. Good. Those are all great answers. And what I would suggest to you is what you're describing is in fact faith. All these components. If you want to understand what Matthew or Mark means by faith, what does the concept mean to him? What's faith about? What's the relationship about in early Christianity? We shouldn't go to our dictionary for definition of faith. We should look at what's happening in the story. So what we have is persistence, hope, the assumption that Jesus has something that's worthwhile, even if it's just the cross. This was on my yesterday's list to talk about, and I didn't get to it. But that in itself is important to realize, that the notion of somebody coming to Jesus, of expecting something from Jesus, we shouldn't take that for granted. It's already there. Now, faith in these stories, sometimes it's not present at all. Whose faith are we talking about here? If we are talking about faith, I don't think we are. Whose is it?
The mother's faith.
The mother's. Not the little girl's. Not the one who's healed. So, which is really interesting. And as I said, sometimes you don't get faith mentioned at all. You've got remember the story of the man let down through the roof? His friends bring him and lower him down. He doesn't even get a speaking part. So if there's faith there, it's the buddies.
And the centurion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's another case where it's the parent.
And it's a command. It's not even. It doesn't even sound like faith.
Yeah, well, and the word persistent. It was a great word. All these, as the, all three of these. Hope, this confidence is coming. You got to help me. You know, it's I need you. They told. How was this phrased here? They told. She heard about you. Okay?
Yes.
He could not escape notice. Yeah, she immediately heard about him. Say, this guy, he's the one you should talk to. You know, you've got that daughter at home. Here's the one you should talk to. She heard about him. So the word gets out. But what the story is primarily about, again, as I said yesterday, Mark obviously assumes that this exorcism happened, this healing happened. But what the story is about is the boundary. The Jesus and the outsiders. Several indications in the scriptures that Jesus, except in Mark even, which is one stick to this gospel, that Jesus' mission is to the Jewish family, the community. But then it gets stretched beyond that. So we get this emphasis here. When those of you that heard Dan's sermon Sunday night know that he kind of worked with the question of Jesus, did Jesus change his mind? Did Jesus have to be kind of instructed and taught about his mission here? When I was on internship, these many years ago, back in that same church where I met Nancy, I ran off with the choir director. One Sunday morning, the Sunday school superintendent came to me and said, can you come down to the first grade or second grade class? They need you down there. And the problem was that this story, or one of the other versions of it, was their lesson. Mm-hmm. And they had a little girl who was in tears, upset about Jesus, having not been willing to help this little girl, and calling her a dog. This was just a little kid, but in a way, she got it. She got the offense of this story. It's so easy for us to skip over that. Tell me a bit about what you do. What do you do with this story? You heard Ben wrestle with it. How do you handle this notion of Jesus? Did Jesus change his mind? What's going on?
I've heard sermons where it's Jesus and the woman having a tit for tat. That is a very Jewish thing. It's a very, Jews love to do things on play on words. Mm-hmm. It's very common in their language. Mm-hmm. And so Jesus was having a little bit of fun.
The rabbinic teacher kind of back and forth, okay?
I wouldn't have considered it fun if I'm talking about
no,
sick
but
kid.
This was a man telling the sermon.
Other thoughts about that? What do you do with this? Yes.
Well, I was reading something yesterday by Beekner, and he actually brought this up, this passage, and I thought, oh, that's so funny because it had just come up in the Sunday sermon, and I had come out of that service going, what is the deal with this anyway? You know, where is he coming from on this? Mm-hmm. And Beekner, I can't remember the other passages that he mentioned, unfortunately, but he mentioned several examples where he thought Jesus had actually kind of messed up to start out with, you know. Mm-hmm. And to me, so maybe it's an example of Jesus' humanity, mm-hmm. that, you know, he was God, but he was human too, and maybe sometimes he didn't see the full picture, and then mm-hmm. and then he, but he was able to rectify the situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the other stories, also in Mark, is another miracle story. I don't know the section of Beekner you were talking about, but where Jesus heals a blind man and tries once, and I can see light, and I can see men like trees walking, and he tries again. which interestingly, Matthew eliminates. He tells the story. We've got to come back to this question of why do these stories get passed on? Yeah.
Well, I think that it's one of those examples where Jesus is actually testing a woman's faith. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, God tends to do that to us every once in a while.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's a fairly common understanding of what's going on, and it's related to this debate, the rabbi debates with the person model. Woman isn't Jewish, but Jesus is, so that it would fit. Is he testing her faith? Again, might be the question of, is this a good time to be testing a woman's faith on this issue? Steve?
I was totally trying to get into the mind of Jesus and why did he not do this, but mm-hmm. I'm just trying to kind of punt and avoid that question. But his purpose in the story seems to be, in part, to emphasize this boundary, mm-hmm. that she has to work so hard to cross it. Whatever Jesus' reasons were, within the story itself, the purpose seems to be to emphasize that there is a huge boundary here that they have to work their way through.
Right. Good. Thank you. And a nice segue to what point I want to make. Go ahead.
Well, you know, perhaps with Jesus, he was setting a boundary. Maybe he was tired, and he said he didn't want people to know that he was there in that community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the way the story starts.
So is there a limit to his energy? It's like when he removed himself to the mountaintop, he mm-hmm. just to limit the energy flow that would need to pass out through him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Also, he could have really felt that his mission was to the Jewish people.
And that's fairly clear. He does say to the children first, mm-hmm. which is... whatever I said to that little kid back in first grade in Suitland, Maryland, it really helped her. She quit crying. And I have no idea what I said. I really was talking about it. It must have been some wonderful insight. But the part of the key to answering this question is to tell us this is the wrong question. And to come back to Steve's point, to think about the fact that this is a story being told as a unit, and the emphasis is on the boundary. There is a boundary there, and it got crossed. So to put too much concentration on the elements of the story is to risk derailing it. The point is, the child was healed. And the bigger point for this particular story is a significant religious, ethnic boundary was crossed. Yesterday we looked at it very quickly at a text in Mark 1, let me just read it to you again quickly. Mark 1, a leper came to Jesus begging him and kneeling. He said to him, "If you choose, you can make me clean." Moved with pity, Jesus stretched out his hand and touched him and said to him, "I do choose, be made clean." I won't read the rest of it. What's the boundary that got crossed there?
Touching someone with leprosy.
He touched somebody with leprosy. Think AIDS. And think 5 years ago. I think we've learned quite a bit in 5 years. But these were the untouchables. They were to go around when anybody got near them, yelling, "Unclean, unclean, stay away from them." This is primitive disease control stuff, of course. But Jesus touched him. Not only healed him, but he touched him. So there too, he crossed the boundary. We have another story. It's not emphasized in that one. It isn't the point John is picking up, Mark is picking up in that story. But it does seem to be what's going on with the Syrophoenician woman and her daughter. What other stories can you think of where Jesus crosses some kind of a boundary?
Excuse me. The woman with the hemorrhage.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yes, yeah, absolutely.
And when she touched him, he said, "Who touched me?" Mm-hmm. She touched his cloak. So there must have been a tremendous amount of energy that he felt that mm-hmm. he left mm-hmm. left him. So maybe his energy was limited.
Yeah. The woman with the hemorrhage, Mark 5. But that is another example also of a boundary crossing, because that was another person who would be unclean, because she had this menstrual problem that was continual bleeding, 8 years, I believe, or 14 years maybe, whatever. It was a long time. And she'd be unclean. He didn't touch her; she touched him, but it'd be the same issue. And that boundary is crossed there. So other stories that you can think of where Jesus crosses boundaries, not necessarily miracle stories.
Samaritan.
Woman at the well. Woman at the well, exactly. Mm-hmm. She's a woman, she's of questionable sexual conduct, she's a Samaritan, so several boundaries. Somebody else want to name one? Was it the same one?
At the temple where he overturned the
Okay, the kind of the institutional religion boundary. This isn't the way we're going to do it, even though This is all the approved system. Bishops don't like that sort of he eats with tax collectors and sinners. It's kind of the label that's put on him. He's a boundary crosser. We don't ever see that, but that's what it amounts to. It's
washing the disciples' feet.
Okay, right. The role of teacher and servant. I, your master, have done this for you, so you ought to do it to one another. That's John, the Gospel of John, I mean. But that's exactly where I want to go now. It's not only that Jesus does it, it's very clear that it's intended to be something that we also do. And not just in modeling Jesus, not just the what would Jesus do, but how does Jesus make it possible for us to cross boundaries? Ephesians 2 is the text I wanted to look at. There are a number of them that we might take a look at. To move from what Jesus does for us to what Jesus does to what he also does for us, makes possible for us. Ephesians 2, verse 11, I'm going to read the first part of this. And listen to how Paul drives home the point. So then remember that at one time, you Gentiles by birth, in other words, you who were born non-Jew, you Gentiles by birth called the uncircumcision by those... Sorry, I'm putting my emphasis in the wrong place. The mark of Judaism, the mark of observance of the Torah, was circumcision of all males. And that was understood to be the distinguished characteristic. So that's part of what he's doing metaphorically here. So then remember that at one time, you Gentiles by birth, called uncircumcision by those who are called the circumcision, a physical circumcision made in the flesh by human hands, remember that you were at that time without Christ, being aliens from the commonwealth of Israel and strangers to the covenant of promise, having no hope and without God in the world. But now in Christ Jesus, you who were once far off have been brought near by the blood of Christ. For he is our peace. In his flesh he has made both groups into one and has broken down the dividing wall, that is, the hostility between us. He has abolished the law with its commandments and ordinances, that he might create in himself one new humanity in place of the two, thus making peace, and might reconcile both groups to God in one body through the cross, thus putting to death that hostility through it. Verse 19, so then you are no longer strangers and aliens, but you are citizens with the saints and also members of the household of God, built upon the foundation of the apostles and prophets, with Christ Jesus himself the cornerstone. So he just hammers it. There is one community. Christ broke it down. You are now one. Christ has, in the body of Christ, on the cross, those divisions are gone. The boundaries, in this case, he says the dividing wall is destroyed. The dividing wall of the law, the Torah, which for the Jews is the that's how they identify themselves. They are the community of the Torah in the scriptures. God's people following the covenant, which is established by God's grace, not a covenant of law. It's not that they are to obey the law in order to earn God's favor, but the law is God's gift to them, and it becomes the mark that distinguishes them from others. Christians say, Paul says, that's no longer a distinguishing mark that separates. In a way, he steps back to the fundamental notions of Judaism, which are the gift of God. It's translated law, because it is law in Greek. But that gift of the Torah, the gift of the relationship with God, he steps behind that to the giver, and says the giver, the one who reconciles all, it destroys those things that have become a dividing wall. Now, with just texts like that, you might say, okay, no boundaries, no human divisions have any significance for Christians and we ought to ignore them all. You have a text like Galatians 3:28, that there's in Christ there's neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, there is no more male and female. A strong statement there, but the picture's a little more complicated, as it so often is. And I told you I wasn't going to answer all the questions today. In 1 Corinthians 8, Romans 14, and Romans 14, I think it's 14, Paul is talking about whether or not to eat food offered to idols. The issue in the ancient world was you've got the temple of Zeus over here, and somebody is making sacrifices in the morning with a portion of the slaughtered goat, and the rest of the goat is given to the temple, and then it's sold in the temple meat market, and that's in lieu of your offering. It's the way that kept things going. That's the meat market for the city. You couldn't be sure, at least, that your meat hadn't been sacrificed to idols. So, do you buy anything from that market or not? What's clearly happening in Corinth is that Christians are saying, hey, these gods, they have no existence. We can eat that meat, no problem. We'll just cross that boundary. That boundary that would separate us, dietary boundary. We can cross that, we're free, we have knowledge. But not everybody thinks that way. And what Paul says to the Corinthians is, beware lest this freedom of yours becomes a stumbling block for somebody else. So he doesn't tell them they're wrong about the boundary, but he tells them you've got to be careful. You've got to think about the implications of your own boundary crossings, the crossings that are given to you in Christ. Let me bring this one into the 21st century for you. Actually, I'll bring it into the 20th century. I'll use the ELCA, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. Most of you, with a few conspicuous exceptions, grew up with the assumption that women could be ordained if you're in part of this church. You didn't grow up with it. You two grew up with it. You three grew up with it. The rest of us went through that big, big debate. And that was a debate that was biblical study. What do those texts mean that say that a woman should be silent in church? I allow no woman to have authority over men, and so on. Lots of biblical study went into that. Lots of wrestling. Decisions were made. And those of you that are old enough to remember know that some of the arguments that were made was, well, yes, that's a convincing argument, but I don't think the church is ready for that. This will cause too much offense. We'll lose members. I don't remember it. They could easily point to a text like 1 Corinthians 8 and say, see, you know, Paul said, yeah, well, sure, we could do that, but for the sake of freedom, we won't. Same argument was made during the civil rights era and over questions of race well, yes, but are we ready? And to some extent, they have a case on the basis of a text like 1 Corinthians 8. Now we have the same thing as people, some are urging us to rethink our understanding of the place of homosexuals in our church. Mm-hmm. I start with the other two because at least in this, the church that I'm a part of, we've kind of settled those questions, even though we continue to wrestle with them. The homosexuality one, that's still more of a live issue, a little hard, we're not quite so at the same point there. But it is another boundary that some of you certainly thought of when I asked you to think of possibilities. So you get the 1 Corinthians 8, Romans 14, 1 makes the same kind of argument. But then you've got the letter to the Galatians, which, as you probably remember, is occasioned by a controversy about circumcision. Is it necessary for Christians to be circumcised? For non-Jews who want to be Christians, do they become Jews first through circumcision and then become Christians? Paul says no. In fact, what Paul says is absolutely not. Or whatever Paul's strongest language is, he never swears, but he comes real close. he says if you maintain that boundary, you've just lost the whole thing. So we've got a complicated question when we look at boundaries. Yes, in Christ we are free to be drawn across the boundaries, to leap over them. In some cases, the boundaries have to be destroyed, the separations. But how do we know for sure how to handle that with some of these things? So there are complexities. And doing this twice in one morning makes it a little confusing. I may have already said, but let me, at the risk of repeating myself, in Judaism, in the Old Testament, you already have a very strong open door policy. Mount Zion is to draw all people. It's the highest of the mountains. It's Bonanza Peak in order to draw everybody to it. My house shall be a house of prayer for all people. When Jesus quotes that, he's quoting the Old Testament. There's a strong element of that tradition already in Judaism, that God is not the God of a tribe, but God is the one God, the God of the universe. And it's worth just stepping back a minute and thinking that's what this is about, the oneness of God, the universal claim of God. If we allow boundaries or divisions from our point of view, then we can't allow them to ever say, well, these are God's people and those aren't. They're outside somehow. We can't allow that. But that doesn't finally solve all the issues for us. The notion of crossing boundaries is really very basic in Christianity. What are some of the, just in very simple terms, describe for me what Jesus does for us. What does Jesus offer us?
Permission.
Permission, okay.
Everlasting life.
Reconciliation.
A guide to living.
Example.
The call to cross the boundaries.
You might have, excuse me?
Forgiveness.
I was wondering if you were, forgiveness, good. Forgiveness, justification. Almost all the terms you mentioned are boundary terms. Forgiveness. In the Lutheran Book of Worship, confession, basic confession of sins, we confess that we have sinned against you by thought, word, and deed. We are separated from God, and God draws us across that boundary. Forgiveness between people. Forgive one another as I have forgiven you. Go across that boundary. Justification means to be put in the right relationship. There's a separation there. Boundaries crossed. Reconciliation. There's alienation. You're reconciled. Eternal life, new life. The difference between the old and the new, there's the boundary that's crossed. Now, I think there was one more that I've forgotten. But the guy between wrong living and right living. You know, just all this notion of boundary being crossed, of God not being limited by anything, and therefore we not being limited. This has implications for. It's a corollary from our understanding of God. It also works the other way. What we experience expands our understanding of God. The Syrophoenician woman story expands our understanding of God as it does of Jesus. Oh yeah, that's right. It's not that boundary. It's bigger, and we ourselves are. By hearing all of these stories about boundaries being crossed, about Christ's making boundaries of no account in terms of the relationship to God, we ourselves are then reminded that we are included. The risk, of course, is if there are some boundaries that count, if gender counts in our relationship with God, whether you're in or out, or ethnicity, that'd be a more likely one, or race, or religious practices, if any of those things count, then the promise of grace to me may be at risk, because maybe something else counts that I don't know about. Even if I'm on the right side of all those boundaries that I know about, which I think is Paul's point in Galatians when he says that if you give in to that one boundary, circumcision, then then it's just like obeying the whole thing. You got the whole weight of it on top of you. But then we have the other boundary that he talks about in 1 Corinthians about respect for the brother and sister and for his or her salvation. Let's talk about boundaries. I started here out by thinking about boundaries that you're aware of. What about those boundaries? What questions are you left with? What do you wrestle with? How do you deal with the things that do separate us? Maybe one thing I should just comment about. We've got what we might loosely call God-given boundaries and human-created boundaries. Gender differences, at least some of them, are just God-given. I mean, there are biological gender differences. So that's God-given. When Paul says there's no more male and female, he's echoing Genesis, but he certainly doesn't mean that we ought to go on then begin pretending there's no difference between men and women. Not what he has in mind. But he does mean that there's something there that no longer makes a difference. We've got other kinds of things, economic differences, for instance. That's just a human developed difference. But as we wrestle with questions, what do you think? As you think about the boundaries that you started, as you thought about the barriers, the divisions among humanity, what do you do with these texts of the love of God for all?
I think a lot of times crossing boundaries takes a lot of knowledge and experience and takes a lot of work.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's just to use an image, must have been Sunday night again at worship. If you were here, remember the exchange of peace takes a long time. People are going around, and I commented about that to the staff member, long-term staff member sitting next to me, and she said, "Yes, but I worry that it's mostly the staff greeting the staff." Or the staff, maybe we should say the staff and the extroverts, the extroverted guests. Greeting the staff and the extroverted guests. Because it takes work to reach out beyond your circle. That's just a homely example, but other things are just as much. So it's hard work.
Maybe you're not allowed to. You may try to cross a boundary, but there are barriers to crossing.
Of course. I mean, if 50 years ago, 40 years ago, if I were black in this room of white people, and I said, I've decided to eliminate the boundaries of race, wouldn't work, would it? Like, there might have been things that I could have done that would have made a difference, but I wouldn't have been allowed to because of that boundary. It's not one that I created.
Doesn't it take work because we're taught that, because our culture says that. It comes to mind my daughter when she was 1 and 2 coming up to, there's a woman in our congregation who's in a wheelchair and is completely debilitated. And she would go and just smile at her for a whole service almost.
Yeah.
And, for other people that'd be very difficult. And for my daughter who didn't know there was a problem with it, it was very easy.
Yeah, yes, a lot of it is certainly learned, accidentally or carefully taught.
I think being able to listen to another point of view from someone who you wouldn't normally be engaging in conversation, but just being able to, or have a difference of opinion with, getting their view, shutting up and listening.
Yeah. Now I've got the question here. Why does this seem to? Well, if in fact it does, I think it does work better at Holden than out in the world for most of us. And why is that? And it may be partly a culture of listening, a learned thing that's what we do here, even though we struggle with diversity on certain kinds of things. Yeah, Dave?
Well, I think of Jesus, these boundaries, a lot of them tie into what were the established norms, order, hierarchy in the church. And a lot of what, you know, with his miracles and his interaction with people and his faith, he was challenged, you know, he was viewed by the Pharisees and the scribes as a huge threat to the whole way of the order and the whole way of doing things. He was really challenging the long-established accepted ways of doing things.
Mm-hmm. Iconoclastic. And apparently challenging also the government authorities, because when it comes right down to it, the religious leaders didn't have authority to crucify him. That's the government. Somehow they were also challenged, threatened by that. And that's another reality about trying to cross boundaries. Not only is it hard work, it can also be very threatening to other people. It can cause lots of resistance.
Any good boundaries? Blessed are the...
that's a very good question. It's one of my questions, and I'll give you one part of my answer, but I'd be interested in what you all think. Are there... I think gender is... one wants to celebrate gender differences, but is it... So in some ways, what do you think? Good boundaries?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, I have to ask you what they are. You're not going to get by with a yes or no.
Well, gender's definitely one.
Okay.
Violence is certainly one.
Okay, sure. Kind of, there's a behavioral boundary. Violence, one is biological, the other is really cultural, as we define what violence is. But almost every culture would say that. There is a limit. There's been somebody around with abolish the death penalty T-shirt on. You know, that's one where we don't agree as to whether that's on which side of the line that's on, but we do agree there's a limit. So, yeah, good. Other things, good boundaries.
Well, I was thinking first of culture in terms of crossing those boundaries, but I also think that different cultural, you know, because I lived in Latin America for 6 years and I visited Africa, and I don't think it's good that we all be from the same culture, which is how some people try to cross cultural boundaries. Mm-hmm. I think there's a richness in all of these different cultures. But then to see the boundaries as so difficult, that's part of the challenge. So, mm-hmm. you know, to be able to perhaps meld the boundaries a little easier might be nice.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. I think age is a good boundary, and we have young people and we have older people, and there are many things that young people are just not ready for, and we don't allow them over onto the other side, and it's necessary to have it that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And yet that's an example of the kind of, as we try to do that well, well, let's take driver's license age, 16 in your state, good to have a limit, an age. Some young people could drive very, very well at 14. Some shouldn't get their license till 22. But there's still a limit, yeah.
But the problem with the boundary of age is sometimes, you know, you're judged and, you know, you shouldn't be.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, in my church, some of the older people don't let me do as much as I would like to.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them judge me, like they don't want me to lecture, you know, they don't want me to participate as much as I would really like to.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I think that it takes away a lot when, you know, if you're younger and you're told you can't be. Mm-hmm.
So two good criteria that I think you mentioned in there. One is where a particular boundary becomes kind of an automatic disqualifier, and then a generalized one. Well, she's too young. Just kind of generally used. And then the other is the failing to account for individual differences. And maybe a third one, is this really a place where that good boundary needs to be applied, like lecturing? Why would that be a problem? Why do you have to be 17 to lecture?
Families really need to set boundaries for guiding their children.
Okay.
respect between individuals and peoples would be a boundary.
Sure. Let me segue from that one to, in my office, the word boundary is most often used in the phrase boundary violation. And what we're talking about is either violation of emotional boundaries, and of course it's usually by clergy that we're dealing with, some, where someone has stepped across an appropriate emotional boundary in a relationship with a person, or the specific instance of sexual boundary violations. And that's that. It is an issue of respect for another person, maintaining differences. So when we talk about Christ knocking down barriers, we're neither talking about eliminating personhood, nor are we talking about, I've forgotten who in here said that about the cultures. I guess the American metaphor is the melting pot. Where we all become the same. That's not apparently either what scripture.
It's now called a salad bowl.
Salad bowl. I am an avocado. other thoughts, questions, issues that you think of? Boundaries. Or, yes.
It seems to me that the human-created boundaries are the ones we want to cross. In other words, I don't think God made a boundary between the races. We've created that ourselves and saying for a period of time, this race is superior to that. Mm-hmm. It seems like generally as I think about it, that it's the ones we've created that are the ones we want to cross.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, race is an interesting example, and even the biologists and the sociologists now write about what is race, and we kind of grew up being able to enumerate the races, and that concept is simply not there. But God did make us different, and it moves into culture. There are obviously skin color differences. That's inconsequential. We're convinced now, most of us, that it is, although not the whole world isn't convinced of that. And 100 years ago, people certainly weren't. Norm Powell talking about, any of you here on Sunday night, when he talked about the Australian outback, and these they were just basically defined as non-humans. The Aboriginals were not non-human.
So you got. I was just wondering, in terms of this whole topic, I wonder if Jesus was here, what boundaries he would be challenging us as individuals to be trying to cross.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like one for me, at least, that I would perceive would be being in this country and the great inequity. So much of the gospel is his solidarity with the poor, and he would be very frustrated with our country's usurpation of resources in the world and how mm-hmm. we exploit the world and we don't steward our services. And
mm-hmm.
there's just not this sharing. And wondering how, as individuals, we're able to try to cross that boundary to form more equity.
I think that gives us an example of a very specific question. What should the institutional church be saying to our government about customs, world trade policies, globalization? That's been very controversial. What about immigration? What is there any Christian defense for limiting immigration into our wealthy country because we want to maintain a lifestyle?
Yes. I think a lot of boundaries are self-maintaining, and a good example of that is a lunchroom.
A what?
A lunchroom.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll see people in a lunchroom partitioned by skin color and by age and by religion. I worked at Westinghouse, and you know, typically the Jews would sit at one table and the Catholics at another table. But there's just a self-partitioning that takes place in a mm-hmm. large collection of people.
And do you think that's good, bad, neutral?
I think there's no morality with that. It's almost unintentional that people just have a comfort level in being with those who are similar and tend to congregate that way.
It reminds me of the high school lunchroom, where kids will also go to the table. But what makes me suspicious that it's not benign is that if somebody from table B sat down at table A, how would they be received? Is it self-perpetuating because people have, to use the old language, learned to keep their place? Or is it self-perpetuating because like attracts like, and even if that is the basis, is that always good? You're absolutely right. We see it in neighborhoods. Interesting studies about how trying to racially integrate neighborhoods, and how it, to some extent, it doesn't work. It flies in the face of what people will do by their desire to have, suppose I'm black, a desire to have, well, at least two black neighbors. And just the mathematics of that will eventually make that neighborhood black or white, whichever direction you're going. It's complicated.
Some of what happened at Columbine was that way. I mean, the students who perpetrated it were isolated, and they felt a lot of pressure from other groups, a big boundary that they couldn't cross, and somehow they were acting out because of that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow. Without condoning their behavior, it makes you think there's something wrong.
Right.
That would get that far.
Mm-hmm.
I think, in addition to the external boundaries that we're talking about, there are boundaries within ourselves. I think I feel this personally with sort of the boundary of fear. For example, I worked in a kind of a pretty boring industry that I just sort of fell into for about 7 years, when the whole time I knew I really wanted to be a musician and do music and teach music, but I think it was the boundary of my own fear of, oh geez, I need a secure lifestyle, I don't want to ever not be able to pay my water bill, was preventing me from taking some risks in my life that would make me happier. I'm starting to get the sense now that I go in that direction that I cross those boundaries of myself, that it leaves me in a place that I can more approach some of these external boundaries that we're talking about.
Okay.
A place of more eliminating that boundary of fear in myself, that I can better approach some of the rest of the boundaries that exist in the world that need to be crossed.
Good. And I think one could make a biblical case for that kind of thing, that the elimination of the internal boundary that says, I am a sinner rejected by God, replacement by, I am a being of worth loved by God, is freeing. Jesus makes a difference in that sense. I was going to give you a really tough question to finish up with, but I guess in 2 minutes I won't. Other kinds of comments?
Give us the tough part.
Yes.
Yeah, sure.
All right.
We have coffee already to discuss it.
let's take what is probably the most divisive question facing our culture and our churches today, and that's our gay and lesbian brothers and sisters. And what does it mean as we deal with that complex of human relationships and institutional realities, how do we apply this? How do we understand what we hear from Christ as we think about a boundary that most of us just kind of took for granted for a long time? It's there, it's right. We at least are no longer able to take it for granted. What are you thinking?
I think it's really simple. That let's not cross the boundary and pretend that we're God. We are not in any position to place judgment. That's God's job, not mine, and I'm not going to place judgment. And I really try and teach my kids that. We don't place judgment on anybody else. Leave it to God. And then And also it's easy for me, then I don't have to worry about it.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
I think it's also, you know, treat others as you would like to be treated. You know, it's not really something that we really need to get into. I mean, it's there and you should, you know, face what's in front of you, but it shouldn't be an issue. You know, if somebody loves somebody else, what can be wrong with that? You know?
Okay. In that one, we'd want to talk about what's love.
Because of Holden, I really got expanded on my understanding of the whole issue enough to go to my bishop and ask if I could get a committee going. That didn't go very far. So then I went to my church and asked if I could teach some lessons. Then I found PFLAG and talked to them, tried to find one gay person that would come and talk with me so that I could set up lessons at the church to educate the people.
PFLAG is Parents and Friends of Lesbian and Gay Persons.
Yes. And so what I ended up doing is getting the parents of gay people to talk to my lessons. These lessons, by the way, grew in that church. Just my friends came the first time, and then and then I did videos. And then we talked about issues, but having the parents of the gay people come and talk to the congregation first was the way to open up some dialogue. Mm-hmm. And my goal was to educate that you can't touch someone and become gay. And I think that's the biggest fear. Mm-hmm. I mean, they might not admit it, but I think that's the biggest fear people get. Mm-hmm. That is catching.
Yeah, or they're... for their children.
Anyway, that's what I did for Gloria Day. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. The more and more we learn biologically, and more it's going to be opened up. And realization that this is a given and not a learned or a behavior that is chosen, then we have greater and greater understanding. Mm-hmm. And realizing the struggle and the pain that these people have gone through.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Ordination?
Why not?
How about bringing back churches that got kicked out because they ordained gay pastors?
Having a family member who's gay makes this not at all an academic question for me. But let me be the institutional leader for a while and just ask you to think about the question of, I talked a moment about boundary violations. Suppose the pastor that one of my pastors, we have pastors who are gay, no question about it. What are the standards? If we don't go with the old standards, then what are the new standards by which I, as a representative of the church, have some expectations of how clergy will conduct themselves in their human relationships? Or even if we say, start using the language of committed relationships, which is what's normally done. We don't just say blanket. What does that mean? We still have to do some talking about so there are still some boundaries there. And we have to rethink the boundaries. Seems to me, and I will just let you go on this note, it seems to me that as Christians, because of what Christ does, we are always being called to question, to talk, to listen to each other about these things, and to hold our sense of what the boundaries is in some tentativity, that these are human constructs which we think we have done faithfully, but we may not have. Entertain the suspicion that you may be wrong. But then we do also have to have some way of talking about how do you respect? What does it mean to respect another person? Let's spell that out. What does that mean for a husband to respect his wife and vice versa? What does it mean for a lesbian woman and her partner to respect one another? What does it mean to love? Even the word love isn't adequate to us in this. So we're not excused by this, by Jesus, the boundary crosser, the one who eliminates boundaries. We're not excused from attention to behavior. We are set free from a notion that those things determine our relationship with God. That is the foundation. And on that, I will leave you. Tomorrow we will talk about food. Thanks for being here. Food and no food.